This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Bradley Cooper has done very well with this year's Golden Globe nominations. His new remake of A Star is Born, which he directed, co-wrote, and stars in, just received 5 nominations in the drama film category: Best Film, Best Actor, Best Director, and Best Actress for Lady Gaga. This is the 4th version of A Star is Born. The 1937 version stars Janet Gaynor and Frederick March. In 1954, it was Judy Garland and James Mason. In 1976, Barbra Streisand and Kris Kristofferson. The premise of the story is similar in each. The leading man, a famous performer, discovers a performer who's incredibly talented but not considered conventionally beautiful. He launches her career, they fall in love, and as she becomes more famous, his drinking or drug use gets out of control, leading him on a downward spiral. In Cooper's version, he plays a guitarist and singer, famous enough to perform in big arenas. Lady Gaga plays a singer-songwriter whose music career consists of performing once a week at a bar, which is where he discovers her. Let's start with the first time he invites her to share the stage with him. The song they're singing is called Shallow.
Tell me something, boy. Aren't you tired trying to fill that void? Or do you need more? Ain't it hard keeping it so hardcore? I'm falling. In all the good times, I find myself longing for change, and in the bad times I fear myself. I'm off the deep end, watch as I dive in. I'll never meet the ground. Crash through the surface when they can't hurt us. We're far from the shallow now. In the shallow.
Bradley Cooper, welcome back to Fresh Air. So, I'm sure you've been asked before, but why did you want to remake A Star is Born? And I'll preface this by saying the Judy Garland version with James Mason is one of my favorite films, outside of a few, like, cringy moments in it. It's just a spectacular movie.
First of all, thank you for having me again. God, yeah, I know. It seems like an odd choice to do this movie, and I agree with you. The James Mason, Judy Garland, George Cukor version is just a masterpiece. And I grew up, you couldn't help but feel the reverberations of the Barbra Streisand, Kris Kristofferson movie. And you know, I was born in 75, and you know, it was just such an iconic visual, sonic film. So, and then I've always wanted to be a director. You know, when I think about being 12 and watching The Elephant Man, it wasn't so much what Anthony Hopkins and John Hurt were doing, it was what David Lynch was doing. And so I would always spend all my time as much as I could in editing rooms and shadowing directors and asking crew members questions and learning about lenses. And so I did start to think about stories I wanted to tell. And I wanted to examine things cinematically, stories about relationships. What happens if a man and a woman or anybody, they fall in love and love each other and there's no infidelity, there's true love, and still how hard it is to endure given, you know, the plight of life. What it is to find your voice as a human being, your identity within this world. All of these things, these were things I thought that I could potentially examine cinematically. And it was like hitting me like a ton of bricks that this structure of the property of A Star is Born could facilitate all of that. And the wonderful weapon in order to do that authentically is that your two main characters are going to have to sing. And you cannot hide when you sing. It's impossible. That's how it all started.
So in your version, your character has heard Lady Gaga's character sing Lovey on Rose at a gay bar that has Friday night drag night. And from what I've heard you say, you decided you really wanted to cast Lady Gaga after seeing her perform Lovey on Rose at a benefit. And so is that why you put it in the film, because you loved her performance of it?
100%. Two reasons. One, that, and I love that song, and I love the way she performs that song. And the other thing is that's actually how I first saw her in that way. When you co-write something and something is personal, I mean, it's rampant throughout the entire film. Anything I could do to make it as real as possible for me or the other actors so we don't have to act. It's actually something very real and old and deep within us that we have a lived experience or a memory or an emotion attached to it in a real way that we don't even have to manifest but can utilize for the story to me is gold. And so I thought, well, I can't trump the Livia and Rose scene. Why, what, she can just sing Livia and Rose. And how can I make that work within the story? So I thought, well, they're all doing covers. It's a drag show, and she's covering Livia and Rose. But yes, the answer is I completely stole it from real life.
Let's hear a little bit of that. When your character first sees the Lady Gaga character sing, he stumbled into this bar, and she's going to sing Livia and Rose. Let's hear a little bit of that.
D'ailleurs qui font baiser les miens en rire qui se perdent sous sa blouse. Voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens.
One of the basics of the story of A Star is Born, of all the versions, is that the man performer is kind of on the way down, and the woman performer, who he helps discover and turn into a star, is on her way up. And that creates a lot of tension between them. Also, the guy's always addicted to something. Cocaine for Kris Kristofferson, alcohol for James Mason and Frederick March. And those things apply in your version too. I'm wondering if you wanted to change anything about the gender politics of the story.
You know, it really came from a place of what interests me, what kind of story am I excited enough about to investigate, to spend all the time and energy that it takes in order to do something like this, which for me was about 4 years. The thing that always amazed me is how I could feel so much for the James Mason character when the movie has told me literally nothing about him. And the only thing we really learn at the end of the movie is the studio head tells the publicist, you know, you have no idea what a good man he was, you know. But other than that, I don't know if he was married, where he's from. No, I know nothing about the guy. He's an actor. That's it. I knew right away I wanted to explore where these characters come from for the audience to know. What is their family situation? Who could potentially be siblings, parents, parental figures? How that would work into their makeup as to where they are today in the world that we meet them. And I always wanted to meet the female character after the ingenue stage. She's 31. What happens? Because I just think about people that I know and what it's like to be through this business. I'm much more interested in somebody who's 31 who has a magical, God-given talent, and they haven't been able to quite allow that to flourish for many reasons. I also was interested in somebody who had success early and found their voice early, but have never had the ability to cultivate the rest of their world. And now they find themselves at 44, and they only have one thing, and they can't live off of that anymore. And so these were two characters I was very interested in.
My guest is Bradley Cooper. He directed, co-wrote, and stars in the new remake of A Star Is Born. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Bradley Cooper. He co-wrote, directed, and stars with Lady Gaga in the new version of A Star Is Born. It's just been nominated for 5 Golden Globes in the drama film category: Best Film, Best Actor, Best Director, and Best Actress for Lady Gaga. Cooper plays Jackson Maine, a famous guitarist and singer who discovers a talented singer-songwriter at a bar. That's Lady Gaga's character, and helps her become a star while he's falling apart from his addictions to alcohol and opioids. Other movies Cooper has starred in include Silver Linings Playbook, American Hustle, and American Sniper. So you deepened your voice for the movie. You really changed your voice. Let's just hear an example of you speaking in the film.
Can I ask you a personal question? Do you write songs or anything?
I don't sing my own songs.
Why?
I just don't feel comfortable.
Why wouldn't you feel comfortable?
Well, because, like, almost every single person that I've come in contact with in the music industry has told me that my nose is too big and that I won't make it.
Your nose is beautiful. Are you showing me your nose right now?
Yeah.
You don't have to show it to me. I've been looking at it all night.
Oh, come on.
So that's Bradley Cooper in A Star Is Born. You've said you modeled your deepened voice on Sam Elliott, who, after deciding to model your voice on him, you convinced him to also play your brother in the movie.
Correct.
So what is it about his voice that you were so taken with?
Well, the main thing I knew is I wanted to start with the voice. I wanted to change my voice because I knew that I wouldn't even believe it as an actor if I kept hearing my voice. I just hear this guy from Philadelphia. So what voice could be wonderfully iconic without being geographically limited? And Tim Monick, an incredible dialect coach who I met with on American Sniper, we started very early on, maybe 2 years prior to filming, sitting down, listening to tons of voices. And at some point, I asked him, "Where's Sam Elliott from? Because I can't quite place his accent." And I had no idea he was from Sacramento, California. And then I learned that his mother is from Texas and was a huge influence on him. And so his voice, he has this accent that you can't quite place. So it felt perfect for the character. And then the journey began. How the heck am I going to get that voice? So it was just hours and hours and hours. We developed a whole series of exercises, and then we would listen to tapes. We met 4 hours a day, 5 days a week for about 6 months steady. And at first it was very difficult. Actually, I could only do it with my head down. And at night I would go to sleep and I felt like my esophagus was lowering into my chest. I had to like forcefully do it. But then after a while it just became so natural, and I could breathe and talk to you and do everything, live my life within that voice. And that was a hurdle that I was terrified I wasn't going to be able to get over. And once I got over that, in that process, I was reading Bruce Springsteen's autobiography, where he was talking about stealing his father's voice when he was young in order to find an identity because he loved his father. And I thought, oh, I can really relate to that. And I thought, what if he literally was so enamored with his brother and wanted to idolize his brother, and he stole his brother's voice, and Sam Elliott is his brother, and there's this connection. And then I asked if I could meet him, and we met, and I played him a tape from an interview he did at the Sundance Film Festival in 2015, I think. But it was me answering all the questions as him on the tape, and he thank God, was moved by it, or I think he certainly felt like, wow, how much time this guy must have spent. and then we just started talking about the movie and the character, and so we just discussed it for about 3 hours one night, and then he said, we left that dinner, and he said, if we can make it work, I'm in.
So you said you used a lot of vocal exercises.
Tons. And I would do it every morning.
To deepen your voice and learn how to... Can you demonstrate one or two of them?
I wish I had the paper with me. But, you know, you do these weird things where you do exercise like 11 benevolent elephants, 11 benevolent elephants, 11 benevolent elephants, and do them, like to get your voice open and your lips relaxed. And where it's so, it's actually kind of crazy, but, you know, it's like, does a person breathe through their nose or their mouth? And where does their tongue lie in their voice? And all those things, it's actually very sort of practical. And then so once you get to that place where you can create a voice box basically that is similar to that's the voice that could make that sound, and then you start literally listening to audio of him and then just repeating what he's saying and trying to get the manner, the melody, the way that he speaks, the breathing in between words, all of those things. So it's really dissecting how someone speaks in their life.
Was your voice coach worried that you would hurt your voice by taking it out of its actual normal range and speaking in a bit of a raspy voice?
No, because it did not hurt my vocal cords at all, because it was completely relaxed. I could yell in that voice. I could whisper in that voice. I never felt strained ever. It's a voice that has a lot of bass to it, so it felt supported. You know, the process of getting there hurt, but once I got there, it's a voice that
supported. Hurt physically or just like it was?
Yeah, physically, meaning in terms of like, you know, I felt like I was physically sort of trying to muscle my way through it.
Now, you also took singing lessons because your character is a singer. Was it the same vocal coach for the speaking and the singing, or two different?
Totally different. This guy, Roger Love, who thank God I met, who was incredible. I remember the first thing he said to me, because I would meet him at 7:30 every morning, and he said, "You're the only person who's ever taken a singing lesson at 7:30 in the morning," because like no one starts till, you know, after 12 normally. He was incredible. I had no idea how to breathe. I knew nothing about singing, nothing. It is such a difficult art form to sing in front of people because you lose your breath right away when you're nervous. And I just, again, had great teachers. Lucas Nelson, Promise of the Real, is Jackson's band. He's an incredible musician who I worked with, he and his band, for hours and hours and hours and hours. And I think it's because I was a good student and listened to great teachers, I was able to do it.
Had you sung before? Had you ever been? Or
no, I sang at gospel choir. I sang at gospel choir at Georgetown. And you know, I did. Here's another little crazy story in terms of a full circle in a weird way. Liza Minnelli came to our grad school to do a sort of master class. And I was one of the people, students, that she would hear sing a song and then, you know, in front of the class, and then dissect and talk about it. And it was Tiny Dancer by Elton John. And I remember I sang in front of the whole school, and then she came up and critiqued it.
Not realizing that you would one day make a remake of her mother's movie.
No, I knew it back then. I said, you know,
yes.
No.
Someday. So when you were on our show after you made American Sniper, which was directed by Clint Eastwood, I had asked you what advice Clint Eastwood gave you about directing, or what advice he gave you, period. And you said two things that you could remember. One was, don't sweat anything too much. And the other was, always shoot rehearsal. And then you said, if I ever get a chance to direct a movie, which I hope I do, I will definitely shoot the rehearsal, because we're basically all trying to pretend that we're saying the words for the first time. Well, there is a first time, so why don't you put it on film? So did you do that?
100%, yeah. First of all, I don't even like to rehearse scenes, meaning like we all sit around and read the sides and then figure it out. That to me, that kills it. I expect all the actors to have done their work, and we show up, and that's the way David O. Russell works. You know, you better be prepared, because the minute you land on that set, you better be ready that he may want to do the scene in the trailer with everybody, or in the van, or on the way. And, you know, so I expect a lot of the actors, and I expect that that I could shoot at any time and we can explore it.
What about the first piece of advice that Clint Eastwood gave you? Don't sweat anything too much.
I need more years to get to master that one.
All right. Well, Bradley Cooper, a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much, and congratulations on the success of A Star is Born.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Bradley Cooper directed, co-wrote, and stars in the remake of A Star is Born. Our next guest, Samin Nusrat, says there are four basic elements of good cooking, and if you understand how they work, you can make delicious food. The four elements are salt, fat, acid, heat. That's also the title of Nusrat's cookbook, which won a James Beard Award last year, and it's the name of her four-part Netflix series in which she travels to different countries to learn more about those elements. For fat, she goes to Italy. For salt, Japan. For acid, she's in Mexico. And for heat, she returns to Berkeley, California, where she lives and where she learned to cook at Alice Waters' famous farm-to-table restaurant, Chez Panisse. Samin Nusrat grew up in San Diego, where her parents immigrated from Iran in the 1970s. Her mother actually appears on the Netflix show and teaches her how to make tadig, the famous Iranian rice dish with a crunchy crust. Nusrat also writes a cooking column for the New York Times Magazine. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.
Samin, welcome to Fresh Air. So the basic premise for the show and for the book is that there are these four elements of cooking, and I'll say them again, salt, fat, acid, and heat. And if you can understand those, you can really become a great cook. So how did you come up with this idea?
I ended up sort of through a series of serendipitous events. I ended up as an apprentice in the kitchen at Chez Panisse restaurant in Berkeley. And I didn't know anything about cooking. I was 19 years old when I started working there. And, you know, I didn't even know the difference between cilantro and parsley. And at the time, the restaurant, it was around the year 2000, and the restaurant was consistently winning best in the country awards. And the cooks are really world class there. And for me, I just looked up to them so much. And they knew how to make everything, and they never looked at recipes. They never looked at cookbooks. They never really even used timers. And it didn't reflect at all anything about cooking that I had understood as a person who read cookbooks at home and practiced at home with really precise measurements. And so the gap of knowledge between where I was and where they were seemed uncrossable. And I just sort of noticed that every day, you know, when we sat down to taste and adjust each dish, we always talked about a few things. We always talked about how we had to adjust the salt, or that something needed a little squeeze of lime, a little bit of acid. And choosing which fat to cook things in made a big difference. And for me, heat, you know, the actual method of cooking, was in some ways the biggest light bulb.
All right, so let's talk about these four elements a little bit. Let's start with salt. You say that salt has the greatest impact on flavor than any other ingredient. And you say that salt makes food taste more like itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think the simplest way that probably most of us can picture or think of is the example of a tomato. If you eat a tomato that you haven't sprinkled salt on, it might taste a little bit bland or just a little bit watery. And once you sprinkle a few crystals of salt on a slice of tomato, some of the juices start to come out, you know, osmosis starts. And a lot of the flavor aromatic compounds in vegetables are inside those watery cells. And so they come to the top, they're more available for you to breathe in. You take a bite, it's juicier. And so you have this taste experience that you couldn't have had without that salt. And the salt really balances the acid in the tomato and the sweetness in the tomato and just makes it more tomato-y. And that's really true for, you know, certainly every vegetable, and I believe for meat too. But to me, my mouth now at this point, salt is the first thing I sort of just instinctively taste for. And I can always tell if something needs a little bit more.
Yeah, one of the biggest takeaways I got from your show and from the book is that unless you have dietary restrictions, you say not to be shy to use salt. And one of the other shocking things of the show is that you use a lot of salt. Like, you were putting salt into a pot of water, and you put so much salt in that it made you wince. So talk about that. Like, I mean, I guess that's everything you cook, but for some things, you're making the water taste like, or trying to taste like, salt water.
Yeah. I mean, also, I'm a little bit of a ham. I'm doing it a little bit performatively, for sure.
Yeah.
But I also, none of those things that I cooked on camera or, you know, that I cook in my classes where I do the same stunt are by any means inedible. In fact, they're often delicious. They're really quite perfect. And even the naysayers and the doubters usually in my classes will come up and be like, wow, I really thought that was going to be impossible to eat, but it's actually so good. And so one of the reasons is that I usually use a kosher salt called Diamond Crystal that's mm-hmm. really the least salty of all the salts.
Yeah, that was something interesting. Sorry, but you said some salts are saltier than other salts.
Yeah, and I think that was, for me as a person who writes recipes, something really frustrating to try to figure out how to convey to people, because just saying a teaspoon of salt in a recipe, you know, all salts are not created equal. So if I am using Diamond Crystal at home and I say 1 teaspoon, but you have, you know, just a box of iodized table salt, what you use will almost be equivalent to twice as much. And so for some recipes, it's not such a big deal, you know, because maybe you're just putting the salt in a pot of water and it will spread out over a large amount of food or volume of liquid or something. But, you know, if you're making chocolate chip cookies and you use twice as much salt, it could be bad news. So I think it's really important, more than anything, to be familiar with your own salt and to really taste as you go. So you start to learn what 1 pinch or 1 spoonful will do to a pot of food.
You also don't recommend using iodized salt.
Yeah, I've gotten some, like, I got a pretty angry email about that
recently.
Oh,
did you? Yeah.
Yeah. And so,
from a salt company or from a customer?
from an iodine champion. And so it was, I think, about 100 years ago when Morton started adding iodine to salt, because in this country, people suffered from a lot of iodine-related deficiency disorders. Mm-hmm. And so it was sort of a simple way to make sure that everyone got enough iodine for thyroid processes and other processes in the body. But these days, we eat a much more diverse diet because of, you know, like, modern transportation, ships produce around the country, and dairy is a really good source of iodine, and seafood is a great source of iodine. So most people, if they eat varied enough diets, can get plenty of iodine through their diet. So you can actually taste the iodine both in the salt and in any pot of water that you season with that salt.
Got it.
And in any food. To me, when I'm adding salt to food, I want it to taste clean. I want it to taste, you know, maybe a little bit like minerally, like the ocean, but I don't want it to taste super metallic. And so that's the main reason why I stay away from iodized salt.
Okay, let's talk about fat. What does fat do? What do we need to know?
So while salt is all about enhancing flavor, fat is mostly about texture, but it's also this amazing sort of transporter of flavor. It's a carrier. And so a great way to sort of imagine that is if you think of a garlic clove, and you have two, if you set up 2 pans next to each other and you put water in one and olive oil in another one, and you just simmered 1 garlic clove in some water and you sizzled a garlic clove in a little bit of olive oil. If you remove the cloves and throw them away, and then you dip your finger in the water and taste it, it'll probably taste pretty much just like water. But if you taste the oil, it'll taste like this amazing perfume and aroma of garlic will have fully penetrated and distributed itself around throughout the oil. And so now you have garlic oil. And if you think about that, that's what fat does for so many of the aromatic compounds and flavors in our cooking, is it distributes flavor. So that's why we start, you know, a soup or a stew, you put oil in the pan and you put your onions in there. And if you're going to add a bay leaf or some coriander seed or whatever, you throw that in at the beginning so it can sort of work its way into that oil and then penetrate your dish fully. So that's one way that fat impacts flavor. It also, you know, most fats have their own flavor. And each culture and cuisine has sort of its go-to fats. And often those fats will determine the taste of the food. So when we think of France, we think of butter. When we think of Italy or Spain, we think of olive oil. When we think of India, we think of ghee. And, you know, if I was trying to make something that tasted Japanese at home, I wouldn't use olive oil. Mm-hmm. Because if I start with olive oil, that will permeate the whole dish and it will never taste properly Japanese. So to make the thing taste of the place, start with the fat of the place.
I was really surprised to learn that olive oil has an expiration date and it doesn't last very long.
I'm so happy we're talking about this.
So, you know, how long can you have olive oil around for?
I mean, it depends how you store it and how it was produced and whether or not it's extra virgin. But in general, it's about a 12 to 14 month life.
So pretty shelf short. Life.
Yeah, it's pretty short. So it's nice to try to become familiar enough with your olive oil that you understand. You can like look at the label, find out the production year, and usually either the production year or an expiration date will be on there. Mm-hmm. And it's important to heed that because it doesn't taste good and it's not really that good for you. And it really, just like if you make a pot of caramelized onions with butter, it'll taste different than if you make it with olive oil. If you make it with rancid olive oil, it'll also affect the whole pot and taste different. So it's a nice like byproduct of my message, I think, for me to be able to educate Americans about that, because I do think we're kind of getting the short end of the stick in a way. Like a lot of the Europeans grow up with the taste of good olive oil, and so they wouldn't accept rancid olive oil from their purveyors, whereas Americans are maybe not as familiar. And so a lot of the oil on shelves in American grocery stores is, if not rancid, then on its way to being off.
Yeah, so how can we tell if our olive oil is rancid?
Well, basically, tasting and smelling it are the two ways. Often, if it's really rancid, you can tell by smelling. And sometimes what I think of is, you know when you open like old-timey peanut butter and it has oil on the top?
Mm-hmm.
And that you have to stir in, that's just the oil usually from the peanuts that's come out. And it's fine for peanut butter, but a lot of the time on a rancid bottle of olive oil, it will have a quality not so dissimilar from that smell of like the way that that oil is kind of like nutty.
Mm-hmm.
Another way that I like to think of it is it smells kind of like crayons. So it just doesn't smell like delicious, fruity olive oil.
Got it.
And when we were in Italy making the show, the producer that we were with, he also pointed out that olive oil should be a little bit spicy going down your throat. Even if it's a nice mild one,
mm-hmm.
there should be a little bit of spice because that's a sign that the oil is still alive.
Okay, on to acid. You say acid balances flavors. How does it do
mm-hmm.
that?
So if you think of lemonade, you know, it's just made of sugar, water, and lemons. So if you were to drink something that was too sugary, it would just sort of not be that exciting to drink. It might be kind of cloying in your
mm-hmm.
throat.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to increase that acid to create that tart contrast. So that balance, that contrast is what acid offers us. And I think for most home cooks, and certainly most people who I've taught, it seems to be the one that's kind of the biggest surprise. Because even the word acid seems so clinical, you know, and scientific.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember even as a young cook, people would use that word in the kitchen. And at first I didn't know what they were talking about. And then over time I realized, oh, it's just lemon, lime, a little vinegar, maybe a splash of wine, or even a little goat cheese or feta cheese. Anything tart is acid. But acid is a thing I think a lot of Americans, we haven't necessarily created a language for it or a palate for it. A lot of other cultures really heavily believe in it, you know, and my family's from Iran, so we have a very acidic palate. We squeeze a sour orange over almost everything, or lime. There's yogurt that we put on, you know, every meal has yogurt.
Yeah, I grew up you said on spaghetti and pizza, too.
Yeah, totally, on everything, much to the horror of many people I met later on in my life. or like pomegranate, you know, now pomegranate uh-huh. molasses is a really kind of popular one. Balsamic vinegar, pickles, and mustard.
Okay, heat. Heat, you say, determines texture. And you made a light bulb go off in my head when you said something. And maybe this is really simple, but that you want to heat something so the outside of the food is cooked or done at the same time as the inside of the food. And then that's kind of complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, a big, big light bulb was understanding that the source of heat is not what matters. You know, I learned because I was learning to cook in a restaurant and I never really had a home cooking background. Mm-hmm. I learned to make braises and stews for 60 people or 100 people at a time. Hmm. And we always did that in the oven. And then one day I went over to a friend's house and she was making a stew on the stovetop. And I was like, wait a minute, you can do that on the stovetop? And she was like, I'm only making 4 chicken legs. And so I realized, oh, all it is that she's doing the same thing. She's bringing it to a boil and turning it down to a simmer and cooking it until it's tender. And we just use the oven because we have to do so much more. So we're using the heat in the same way. And it doesn't matter so much what that source of heat is.
Along those lines, you say that cooking in the oven is actually kind of more complicated than we think it is.
Yeah, I think we sort of associate it as this very straightforward and simple thing. Like you set the dial, you put something in there, and then, you know, you come back 18 minutes later and it's done. But in my experience, like no two ovens are the same. Even my oven, you know, on different days acts differently. And depending on what the weather is outside, what the weather is inside, if your thermostat is old or new, if it's accurate or not, how many times you've opened the oven door, a million different things will affect that temperature. And so very rarely is that actual temperature in there the very specific thing to which you've set the dial. In fact, a lot of those thermostats have sort of like a plus or minus mm-hmm. of up to 20 degrees.
That's a lot.
And so it's crazy. You might set it to 350 and it could be anywhere between 330 and 370. Mm. So, you know, we have this false sense of precision when we cook in the oven, but it's actually in some ways the least precise form of cooking because I think it also gives you this false sense of, oh, well, I don't need to like pay attention. So you sort of turn down your senses and you're paying less attention. And that is often where things go wrong. So I watch my oven things like a hawk. I do set timers, but mostly to remind me to move things around because the back will always be hotter than the front. Mm-hmm. And in my oven, the left side is hotter. But if I'm cooking at someone else's house, maybe the right side is hotter. So I rotate things. I move them up and down, up different racks. And I'm just always paying attention so that I can know when the thing is done.
Well, one of the things I like about the fact that your book is illustrated, and apart from the fact that the illustrations are just beautiful, is that there's no photographs in the book. And I feel like a lot of times when you have a cookbook and there's photos, people are always disappointed, like, oh, what I made doesn't look anything like the photograph. And so there's like this perfectionism built into that kind of style of cookbook.
What I make doesn't even look like the photograph. I mean, usually, especially anytime I've worked on a shoot, mm-hmm. There are multiple stylists there and there's lighting. And, you know, I'm not a food stylist. I don't make food for photos. I make mm-hmm. food for people. And I felt very much that I didn't want to tell people, I didn't want to sell them something that I knew that they wouldn't ever be able to get themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm that perfectionist too. Mm-hmm. And so I always have to fight against those tendencies in myself. And I knew that my message in this book was one of trying to get you a little bit looser and less dependent mm-hmm. on measurements and like perfection. And to understand the thinking behind a recipe mm-hmm. so that if something calls for chard but you only have spinach, you can use that. Hmm. Or if it calls for chicken breast but you only have pork loin, you understand that those are both tender, quick-cooking cuts of meat and you can substitute them for one another. And so if I gave you a picture of what my version looked like on a particular day, it would be kind of disingenuous. You know, it wouldn't match up to my message. Because yours probably won't look like that if you're actually doing what I hope you do, which is make the decisions that help you in the moment make the best possible meal for your own self and your loved ones.
Let's talk about the show a little bit. One of the things I really love about the show is the experts that you have, the people that you've chosen to present various food cultures. You know, there's a lot of grandmas on your show. There's a lot of rural people. There's a lot of people of color. They're not really the typical experts you see on cooking shows.
You know, when I started cooking, I was told repeatedly that I wouldn't know anything about cooking until I'd been doing it for 10 years. Hmm. And after I was doing it for 10 years, that it would like be in my body, you know, and then later Malcolm Gladwell wrote his 10,000 hours, which is the same thing, right? Yeah. Do it till you master it. And by that kind of thinking, if practice leads to mastery, then I've always thought, well, then who are the most masterful cooks?
You gotta talk to the grandmas, yeah.
Yeah. And who are the people who've been doing it the longest and often with the least resources? You know, even at my house where I grew up, like, I would go home early in my cooking career and just be, like, horrified, really realizing that my mom, like, used the dullest knives of all time. You know, and she, Persian cooking, which she's so good at, involves a lot of chopping, a lot. And if she just had sharper knives, it would be a lot easier and faster. But she would never let me sharpen her knife. She's like, no, I like them this way. And I've found that...
We'll talk about your mom later.
Yeah. The amazing thing is that, like, you know, it's easy in the bubble of a professional kitchen to get really sort of, like, finicky about your tools and your resources. And then you go out into the world and you see people making so much out of so little. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think I have always been inspired by, like, the peasant cooking and the grandma cooking, because in general, like, the story behind that kind of cooking is it's people who had to feed a lot of people without a lot.
I think that the show itself is kind of a warming experience watching it. And I do think a lot of it is because of you. You're this very joyful person. It looks like you're having a lot of fun while you were filming it. You're very exuberant. You have a very expressive face that looks, you know, you wear your emotions on your face. But
I had a joke that I was like I mean, it's not a joke. It's the truth that I'm the worst actress.
Well, that's what
world.
I was going to ask you. Yeah. Because I read that you're a terrible actor because of it, because so you can't bad. Fake it.
And you know, it became a problem. Yeah. I'm sorry to talk over you.
No. So how did that come into play in making the show? Like,
well, we all learned a lot about each other as we went along, uh-huh. You know, and, I think we all realized very quickly that while I'm really good in certain ways, like, I can do a million takes of any cooking thing. Mm-hmm. I can tell any story 1 million times with the same amount of joy. But I cannot pretend to be surprised when I meet someone this 15th time.
Yeah, so I heard that they wouldn't show you who you're meeting. Like, they would hide the people from you so they get the first take.
They started sequestering me. Like, I would have to hide in the van with, like, a coat over my face. Or, like, one time in Mexico, we drove around the block, like, 9 times. Where I was the butt of a lot of jokes, which I'm totally comfortable being.
So when you were talking about making the show with your director, Caroline Sue, it sounds like you talked about wanting to present feminism in the kitchen. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because, you know, the kitchen has historically been a place that feminists felt trapped in.
Yes, absolutely. Like, historically, especially in the States, a big part of, let's say, women's liberation and feminism and that first wave of feminism was about getting women out of the kitchen because, like, household chores were not equitable. And it became this, like, very important symbol for feminism to get that to be not the main duty of only women. But to me, you know, I believe one definition of feminism is, like, equal rights for all, treating all people equally. Mm-hmm. And that means sharing all household duties equally. So I think as far as cooking goes and teaching people to cook, I hope to teach all people to cook. It has nothing to do with gender. And perhaps by inspiring more people, I can inspire more men to take interest in it and bring them into the kitchen. But in terms of the power of a platform and the power of media, listen, like, there are so many other shows where you can see all of these fancy restaurant chefs, most of whom are men, most of whom are white men, you know, and they're getting featured. But this show is about home cooking. And home cooking, often home cooks don't get credit for their work, don't get paid for their labor. And more often than not, for the last 10,000 years, they've been women. So 200 years ago about is when restaurants started. And when restaurants started, men entered the kitchen. And there was pay involved and glory and awards and titles. And then the professional kitchen became the men's place. And that's been reflected in media. And this was an opportunity for me to elevate and honor home cooks, most of whom are women and have been women for the great part of human history. And I don't think that that's always acknowledged by the media. So I think once we had that discussion, we were all on the same page.
You also have your own mom as an expert on the show, and you have her teach you to make the Persian rice dish tadik. And it seems like you have a little apprehension about that.
You know what my friend pointed out the other day?
What?
She said, you know, your mom's on the fourth episode, so by then we've seen you go all around the world with all these other people, and you're so joyful, and you're so over the top and loving and open, and then your mom comes up, and just imperceptibly, you tense up.
Yeah, you totally do. There's this, like, kind of friendly tension throughout that whole scene.
Yeah, at one point, accurate.
Yeah, you say, like, this might be the first time we've ever agreed about anything, and she says, let's keep it that way.
Totally. I mean, I knew that it would not be easy. It wouldn't be the easiest scene, but I just knew it would be make amazing television. And in a way, I mean, I was so happy to get to include her in my work. You know, my parents are immigrants. Like, I think in a lot of ways, they don't really understand. My mom isn't on the internet a lot. Mm-hmm. She doesn't really get what Netflix is or what the power of that is. She doesn't really text. She knows I wrote a book. She knows it was popular. I don't think she gets what I do, you know? Mm-hmm. And so this was a way for her to get to be involved. And I felt really happy to be able to do that.
Yeah, well, your parents moved to San Diego right before the Iranian Revolution, and you were born there. And you said that you learned to be a chameleon as a way to adapt to situations like living in a pretty white town like San Diego or going to UC Berkeley. Is it exhausting to be a chameleon? Like, do you feel like you always have to be on?
Not necessarily on. Definitely sometimes exhausting. You know, another word for it's code switching. That's
right.
Like the more sort of like whatever. But yeah, it's definitely, it can get hard to remember who I am underneath all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I started going to therapy about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was one of the first times anybody asked me, you know, how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And that I really like took that as a question that needed to be answered instead of like polite, oh, I'm fine. You know, thank you so much for asking.
Right.
And still sometimes like my therapist will say like, what would bring you joy today? Or what's fun? And I'm like, what's fun? I don't know. I only know hard work, you know? And so I think for me in this, like, I would say last 10 years, I've been spending a lot of my time and thoughts and energy trying to figure out who I am when no one's looking, and how do I be that person when people are looking?
Well, Samin Nosrat, thank you so much for coming to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
Samin Nosrat hosts the 4-part Netflix series Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, which is also the title of her best-selling cookbook. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly CV Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.